This is the Military Bottom Line Podcast, episode 89.
And the importance in that transition, I just want to mention really quick, is mental and emotional resiliency. If you don't have mental and emotional resiliency, you're not going to transfer. You're not going to begin to redirect that energy and that momentum. And this is why physical exercise is just such a pinnacle cornerstone of my existence.
Welcome to the Military Bottom Line Podcast, where we learn from veterans and those currently serving how to make the most out of a military contract. We are here to motivate, inspire, and help you leverage your service to positively impact you professionally, personally, and financially during your military career and beyond. What's going on, everybody? I'm super excited to introduce to you today Joe Malone. Joe is a former MARSOC Marine operator who did 4 years initially as Motor T, got out of the Marine Corps, and was living the good life when somebody said something to him that changed the trajectory of his life. And from there on, he went out to assessment and selection, did multiple deployments as a Special Operations Marine, and now is operating and starting his own business, Lethal U. So I really hope you guys enjoy this episode, get something out of it, and I'll see you guys at the end. Joe Malone, what's up, man?
What's going on, brother?
Dude, it's so funny. We met like, I don't know, it's got to be like 10 years ago now, before you went to assessment and selection, surfing out in Oceanside. And then just like within the last year, I saw your content like everywhere. I'm like, dude, I know that guy. So naturally, I wanted to catch up. I know you've been doing some MARSOC stuff for some years, and now you've transitioned out. So I'm excited to hear your story.
Yeah, no, it's crazy how fast time flies, man. I mean, and I think the last time I saw you was like 9 or 10 years ago or something like that. It's been a while.
It has been a while. So yeah, I'd love to kind of, you know, hear your story. I know a little bit of it, but kind of like how it started, why and when you joined the military in the first place.
Yeah. Grew up in Chicago, Southwest area, Southwest side of Chicago, and just got involved with a really bad group of people at a really early age. I think I've done every single drug possible before I was 18 years old, you know, shooting up dope and smoking crack and tripping, you know, on a bunch of hallucinogens. But my best friend ended up joining the Marines in 2005 when we were 18. I saw his transformation and kind of was stunned. So I knew that, you know, I was going to either die or, you know, do something else. And that I didn't want him to go to war by himself. And so even though we never served directly with each other overseas, I ended up joining, and that's kind of what led me to the trajectory I was on.
Right on. So for you, it was mostly just kind of about escaping your current situation and joining your friend.
Yeah. And, you know, there was, you know, 9/11, I was 14. I remember it very vividly. And just a lot of divisiveness in the country. And I was kind of just bought into the whole, well, we need to go to war with somebody idea and concept. I don't necessarily agree with that anymore to a certain degree. But, you know, there was some patriotism involved in it.
Sure. Okay. All right. So I'm trying to remember when I met you, I'm trying to remember if you were in the reserves or had already completed your first contract. So when you first joined, what did you join for? What job did you get? What did that first stint look like?
Yeah, I went in to do infantry, and then my girlfriend at the time convinced me otherwise. So I asked the guy what was the next most intense job, and he told me Motor T, truck driver. And that job sucked. I fucking hated it. hated it so much. But it did get me a lot of really great opportunity, and I did get to go a lot of places. I deployed a lot. I deployed 4 times in my first 4 years. Okay. And, you know, I got to work with some really awesome infantry units and drop off snipers a couple of times. And so even though I was never a part of the mission set, you know, the main effort, it was pretty cool to see things from a support position.
You said 4 times in the first 4 years?
Yeah.
All to Afghanistan?
No, three MUs, so 3 non-combat, and then one to Afghanistan, which was really cool. I was a part of one of the METs, the ETTs. So I was an embedded trainer, and we were teaching like hundreds and hundreds of Afghans how to drive stick shift trucks in the Hindu Kush mountain range up in the northeastern part of the country, which was crazy dangerous. I didn't even know how to drive a stick. That's where I learned, was in the mountains, and I had a couple of close calls stalling out. But yeah, it was an interesting deployment. It was cool.
All right, right on. And so you, when did the transition happen? I mean, you're Motor T, not loving it, but kind of getting to do some cool stuff at the same time. When did this whole MARSOC thing start kind of coming up for you?
It was really interesting. So I was leaving Afghanistan I got home on July 4th of 2010 from Afghanistan. And it's ironic. That happened to me two times for another deployment. But I was on my way home, leaving country, and I ran into an old ammo tech that I knew, and he was deployed with a MARSOC team in support. And I ended up meeting a couple of guys in Kabul International Airport, and they were getting ready to set off on this crazy mission. And these dudes were slugging vodka, telling me about their, you know, stories and stuff. And I was kind of just like, damn, you know, that's pretty cool. Always had like a lust for something like that, and was pissed that I joined Motor T. So a couple days later, I'm back in the States, and I found out that dude died. His name was Chris Antonick. And I don't know why, but that bothered me. I don't know why. And so my time out, MARSOC was so new. They were only accepting, you know, Force Recon at the time. And there was I don't know if you remember the guy Chicken, Matt's friend Chicken.
Man, that name sounds familiar. I remember the nickname. I don't know if I ever met him.
He was like super Democrat for no reason other than just to whatever. you know, his political views were regardless, but he served with Matt in the Army. And one night, you know, I was like bitching about how I wish I would have joined like, you know, infantry or whatever. And he kind of, you know, he wasn't like putting me in my place, but he did say something that resonated with me where he goes, "Why don't you just stop talking about it and go be about it?" And at this point, personal life was pretty jacked up. You know, I don't know if you knew, I was having an affair with that chick, which is why I got kicked out of the house. And when I was living with like Matt and Rob and stuff, and rightfully so, I wouldn't want that crap around my house either if I was them. Yeah. And I was surfing all the time and, you know, just basically smoking weed. And my life was pretty good for the most part, but it really just bothered me. I was like, man, he's right. And so I went online and I researched MARSOC assessment and selection. And it was like that day they came out with a MAR admin and administrative letter opening up assessment and selection to the inactive reserve.
No kidding.
And I just remember sitting in this like shanty room of mine. And I was like, this got to be like some sort of a sign. And so I went on the base like a few days later, started talking to the recruiter offices, and nobody knew what to do because nobody had actually done it. There had been no inactive reserve guys. So I might have even been like one of the first to do it. I don't know, but nobody knew how to help me. And so that's kind of where that all began. I ended up joining 4th LAR as a reservist, but I told them straight up, I was like, I'm not here to do reserve anything. I'm here to go to selection and that's it. And if this doesn't work out, I'm gone. Like I was not about to be in the Marine Corps and not be a MARSOC, dude. No way.
And you had just gotten out basically. I mean, how long had you been out at that point?
I think it was 9-12 months, something like that. Okay. And I just don't like the Marines. I don't like the Marine Corps. I hate so much of what it's about. It's just a bunch of asinine, egomaniacal douchebags who just get promoted yelling at each other all day about walking in grass when there's so much more that could be done and figured out and solved. But yeah, I'm not a big fan of the institution as a whole to begin with. So joined LAR, got enough people on my side to where they said, cool, go to selection. So I drilled out, went to selection, got selected, went through ITC, passed ITC. And at that point is when I had to re-enlist. And so, yeah.
So when you did your contract, you got out, you were in the IRR, just like everybody's got the IRR time. And then you re-signed in. Do you know if it was an IMA position? Like because you went into the reserves with LAR, if you did not get accepted to MARSOC, were you able to walk?
Yeah.
So it was a non-obligatory reserve contract.
Correct. Yeah, it was. That's what I think they called it, actually, where I could have walked at any point in time. Gotcha. I never signed a reserve contract. Yeah, they had like open billets or something. It just all worked out really. It worked out so seamlessly that I can't help but believe it was divine intervention in some form or capacity.
I'm curious, after 9 months in kind of the civilian world, I guess, you know, what phase of your transition were you in as far as your mental state, your mentality, like what you were thinking for your future? Like what were you doing in that 9 months? Were you like regretting getting out, or what was your thought process?
Not at all. I was loving my life, dude. The only problems I really had in my life at that time was this stupid relationship I was in with this chick who was married. Other than that, I was literally loving my life. I was like dog sitting for rich people down in like, you know, Solana Beach, making enough money to get by. I was living on the beach in Oceanside, right on the strand. I was surfing. I would longboard everywhere. I was saving like a couple hundred bucks a month. So all my like everything was just like, I was going through paramedic school.
That's right.
And dude, life was just great. And I was actually angry at myself for wanting to go into MARSOC. Like I couldn't shake it. And I knew that I would hate myself forever if I didn't. And I knew that I would hate myself forever if I did. So I was just like, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you feel, I don't know, just curious, like, were you proving something to yourself, to something, somebody else? I mean, what was it that you were seeking other than, I guess, checking a box that you kind of had this thing in the back of your head, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it had some stuff to do with proving to myself, not anything to anybody else. I mean, I was so content with my life at that time. I yearned to get back to that level of presence and contentment because I had no responsibilities.
Yeah, and I
wasn't living like a dishonest life other than the relationship but that was her. I wasn't lying about that to anybody. And I just love being completely transparent. I love having nobody rely on me. I loved just being able to sit and stare at the ocean literally all freaking day long if I wanted to. And I really enjoyed that. I wanted closure on like Afghanistan. For some reason, I thought this would give me closure. And I wanted to kind of prove to myself that I could because of, what that guy Chicken Dam said, you know, don't talk about it, be about it. And so I was like, all right, fine, fucker, you know.
And I was like, you did it. Yeah, you made it through assessment and selection. I did a couple deployments, right? How many deployments in MARSOC?
Yeah, I did three with MARSOC.
Three, okay. And what time frame is this now? By the time you get back in active duty, what were your new active duty years?
Yeah, selection was 2012. ITC was 12 into 13, 10th class. And then I deployed right away. So we graduated like August of 13 and I deployed in the first half of 14. Okay. I was pretty lucky. I got sent over to 2nd Battalion, CENTCOM region, and right away knew I was going to Afghanistan again. And yeah.
Got it. Did it deliver what you were looking for?
No, not at all. I was you know, my mentality, my attitude was so different from everybody else's. Like when I showed up to ITC, I had just driven across country, ate like a bunch of mushrooms in Boulder, Colorado, like, you know, wandered around, showed up in board shorts with like no shave for like 10 days and was like, hey, bro, where do I check in with like my alpha slung over my arm and my shoulder? And everybody just like didn't like that. And so that attitude, even though I tightened it up quite a bit, I almost got kicked out of ITC because of that. But I wasn't happy about being in the Marines and I just wanted to work. I just wanted to do work and I didn't care what anybody thought about me. And surprisingly, people thought I was very abrasive because of that, which is weird because one second I'm a hippie, the next second I'm abrasive, you know, and I just was driven to do work. I wanted to be the first man in the door. You know, I wasn't married. I had nothing else really going for me. And this is what I was here to do. And so put me in, coach, let me shoot some people. Let me get shot at. If I get hit, I really, truly accepted that. And I didn't give a fuck. Like I truly accepted that I would probably die. And I was okay with that because of my position on the team, my position in marriage and in life. And these other guys were married with kids. And, you know, ironically enough, most of the dudes that ended up dying had families, but, I was just very hungry. And that deployment was very slow. We were breaking everything down and, regressing operations. And then Chuck Strong got killed on a bullshit operation because some commander came in and wanted to, you know, oh, well, you have to do operations in order for me to get promoted. And then, you know, it ended up killing a guy. Yeah. So I was just really mind spun by the end of that one.
And that was your first one, your first deployment?
With MARSOC, yeah.
Okay. At what point did you know, I mean, throughout your MARSOC contract, what was the thought process of like, okay, I did this and now, like, now I know I'm done and now I can't wait for that end of contract? Like, how far into it were you when you said, that's it?
I don't think I even graduated ITC.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually almost, so after ITC was when I had to reenlist for 5 years. So I've already done 2 years of this inactive reserve time, just going through training basically. And I almost didn't reenlist because they shafted me on a bonus. Everybody else got these bonuses and they said, well, you were inactive reserve, so you don't get a bonus. And I was like, what the, you know? And so I actually told them, I was like, I'm not reenlisting. And of course that was like a big deal to the command because they just put, you know, all this money into me and stuff. So I ended up caving, but I was so pissed off. Just not, it wasn't even over the money. It was just like the principle of everything. Yeah. And I, again, it's like, I'm not even reenlisted yet. And you guys are already giving me the shaft. Mm-hmm. And you know, I could literally walk right now and go surf back on the beach in California. Like I wanted to be there more than anybody else wanted to be there. And I proved that because I was the only one who had the ability to walk. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just typical Marine Force stuff. Nobody cares, you know? And so,
yeah. So a 6-year contract. I mean, you know, everybody sees the cool guy stuff. They see the cool pictures, the Instagram, the YouTube of doing halos and stuff. Did it, you know, did you get those opportunities? Did it live up to the hype that people live, you know, kind of make up in their mind?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, like after that deployment in 14, I went to another team, another company, very senior team, and we were ramping up for Iraq and we knew it was going to be kinetic. And that's like when my life really started to just like take off in terms of like, just, I don't know what you want to call it, like operator syndrome or something. I mean, I was slugging booze, doing crazy training, blowing stuff up, jumping out of planes, you know, hanging out with all these different chicks. I mean, my life just started to really unfold and really unravel really quickly because of the high operation tempo and the high stress and all this stuff. And the one thing I would say, though, is that it's never like that. You know, it never lives up to the hype. Yeah. Until like you objective, until you kind of like look back at it. Lots of PowerPoint, lots of trying to figure things out on your own, and a lot of just roadblocks from the Marine Corps. Mm. You look at the other soft units and the whole time you're just thinking to yourself, I should have been a Green Beret. I should have been a SEAL. Maybe I should try out for Delta. Like
thinking the grass is greener.
Well, it is. I mean, it truly is. Like it really is greener in those other units. They get paid better. First of all, they get better SDA pay. They get like demo pay, which we don't get. You get, it's more of a big boys club. Like they actually treat you like real adults, where in the Marine Corps, you're always fighting back that stupid Marine Corps. Marines are who we are. Special operations is what we do. That's the dumbest saying I've ever heard in the world. It is so stupid. You can't be a Marine, a closed box minded dumb fuck. Sorry, again, I don't know if I'm supposed to be swearing on these, blocked out, whatever. But like, it just would bug me so much when we had to like answer to all this like stupid stuff. And we're trying to solve real world problems and we're getting put out in real operational environments where we're alone, we're solo. There is no QRF coming, there's no medevac coming. And it's like in the process of like trying to figure this stuff out, you know, I get yelled at because, yeah, I don't know, I'm walking on grass. It's like,
Yeah. That's the quintessential example used, is the whole walking on grass rule in the Marine Corps.
It really is, man. Why? Yeah. Because it's so dumb. And I get it. Don't mess up the grass. But you know what I'm saying? I would say, though, the one thing that they should show in all those commercials is PowerPoint. You need to be good at PowerPoint and you need to know how to brief. And if you're not good at PowerPoint, then you're going to fail in the teams really quickly. That's for sure.
Interesting. Yeah. All right. So practice running and rucking and PowerPoint presentations. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Right on. So how did your transition go? Because I know you made a comment about how your career didn't end exactly how you wanted it to end. And I feel like of other podcasts I've listened to, it seems like a common theme amongst people in special operations that like something always gets jacked up on the exit. I don't know if that's something you want to share, if it segues into kind of what you're doing now. How did your transition out go?
After my second deployment, so we were in Iraq, came back, and that was a good deployment. I worked my way up from a element member, AEL, assistant element leader, and then now I had my own element, and we were getting ready to go back to Iraq, senior team. Like, you know, and then I had the option to go to sniper school finally, and I've always wanted to go to Marine sniper school. Mm-hmm. I had the option to go to the MARSOC advanced sniper course, and I turned it down, and I gave it to my assistant element leader for the sole purpose that I was like, take it. I want to go through basic sniper. I'll go to that one later. And this is actually what last time I saw Matt was I went to California for sniper school, and I got I got promoted, and I wore the rank that I got promoted to without an official promotion ceremony. And there was a misunderstanding in the course about like some assignment. I mean, it was legitimately a misunderstanding, and I was helping dudes out. I was crushing the course. Like, I was just fucking destroying it. Me and my partner were. And, they just made the biggest deal about this like homework assignment. And I legitimately misunderstood what they were talking about. And instead of like, just, you know, guiding me on it and being good instructors, they crushed my nuts. And then the first sergeant came in and he was like, who promoted you? And I lied. I said, some captain down the road. Mm-hmm. And I remember later that day, I went to Matt's house and I was like, I don't know why this is bothering me, but I lied about that. And it's just like, mm-hmm. bothers. It was really, cause I'm a big guy on like transparency and integrity. And except for in the years that followed this incident, for some reason, I just wasn't. But, they investigated it and they came back and I'd gotten poison oak. It was like all these things were just coming together. I had my eye was so swollen. I had six flaps in my eyelid, and that's sure. both eyelids. My nuts were the size of literal oranges. My groin was completely covered in poison oak. Everything from my knees to the top of my head. The hospital wanted to drop me from the course, and I said, no. They said, you don't understand. You need we need to make sure you have an open airway. We want to hospitalize you. And I was like, no. And because there's 2 weeks left. So the stupid assignment, the promotion thing that they investigated, and then this poison oak, physical debacle, caused me to fail a physical event, which has never happened before, never happened since. And it was everything in the universe was just work ever since I told that lie. It was it was almost I don't know, God was just punishing me. And so I got kicked out of the course with a few days left. Got back to the East Coast. They stripped me of my team. They stripped me of my element. They NJP'd me. They busted me down to a corporal. They suspended the corporal thing, basically put me on probation or whatever you call it. And then they stuck me in the training office. And then I was just this bastardized dude who was a shitbag, and nobody would talk to me or do anything with me. And I got myself into, because the team guys who knew me, they, most of them for the most part, liked me. They knew I was a good, solid worker. And I kind of finagled my way into this intel billet for one of the deploying companies back over to Iraq. So I go over there, and then 2 weeks in, the C-130 falls apart in the middle of the sky. And that's when I find out that that was my element. You know, that was my team. That was essentially, it felt like that was the plane that I was supposed to be on, and not Billy Kundrat, the guy who replaced me when I got kicked off. And I mean, you can just imagine the mix of emotion and thoughts where it's like, why is all this stuff happening to me? Why am I getting kicked out of this course? Like, why is everybody making such a big fucking deal about what's taking place right now? It just didn't add up to me. Mm. And then now you find out that a plane literally falls apart at 25,000 feet, carrying everybody that you were supposed to be with. And I just started to have a lot of guilt, a lot of confusion. What really sucked was that nobody back in the States on the team even wanted me to be there. They were kind of like, you're a shitbag. We don't even want you here. Yeah. Excommunicated, if you will. And so now I'm just kind of I don't know,
How much time did you have left on your contract at that point? I mean, did you already knew you were getting out? So you're like, I just got to wait this out 6 months, year. I mean, how?
Yeah, it was like 12 or 18 months or something like that.
Gotcha.
And like I needed like surgeries and stuff, you know, like I wasn't just going to go back and get out. And then what made it even worse is that they came out with a new MR admin saying, hey, you can't be deployed for more than X amount of days. Well, when that came out, I actually had like more deployment time than anybody in all of like the command. So they immediately sent me home. They like that came out and they're like, hey, you're going home in 2 weeks. So this is like 4 months into a 6 month deployment. You know, they're like, hey, you're going home. So again, my world is just getting spun around. I had nowhere to live when I got back. Yeah. And at that point, I went to the TBI clinic just to, I was like, dude, what the fuck, you know? And they, you know, found out I'd been concussed a bunch of times and found some stuff. I got some surgeries done and took too many medications, too many prescription meds. They kind of gave me at first and just kind of further spiraled my insanity. And then, you know, when I EAS'd, I was living on Onslow Beach in a tent, putting a gun in my mouth every single day for, I don't know, maybe 3 months. I wasn't living on the beach that long. I was living in an empty, overpriced apartment downtown Wilmington, literally nothing in the whole place except a mattress and an ottoman that I still have here at my house to kind of serve as like memory. Mm-hmm. But it was like dark, dude. I mean, I literally shot my gun inside of the house and I waited to see if anybody would come and find my dead body for like 3 days. Nobody from the command called. I almost murdered a dude. You know, it was crazy.
That's intense, man. I appreciate you sharing that. I imagine there are numerous, you know, internal conflicts and emotional struggles along with that. And I, you know, I can relate to an exit of the military that wasn't, you know, really what you wanted. And I'd be curious what your process looked like to put that all back together. I mean, you're getting out, I'm sure, you know, identity issues. What the heck do I do now? You know, how do you repair that? How do you fix yourself like that?
Yeah. And honestly, I don't even remember exactly what transpired. I just knew there was one night and it just got wild. That was the night I almost murdered a guy. I was going to do a murder suicide. Thankfully I didn't. That would have been pretty bad. But I mean, like when I say I was going to, like I was on my way to go kill this guy. And thankfully I was so drunk, I couldn't even make it out of the fucking apartments. And then a buddy of mine who knew I was in distress kind of like came and found me. I just knew that I was like, what is going on with me? Like, why do I act this way? And I was like, well, when do I act this way? And I was like, okay, well, it's when you drink. Well, when do you drink? It's at night. Okay. So how do I avoid that? And I was like, go to bed early. And I was taking sleeping pills at the time. I don't anymore, but I would just take a sleeping pill. I would literally get back from like all my medical appointments all day long, because that's all my work was at this time. And I would get home. It'd be like 5, maybe 6 PM. Turn off the phone, keep the lights down low, drink some chamomile tea, crush like a homework assignment, because I was like, I got to like do something productive. So I finished like my bachelor's degree, or I started to finish it at the time. And boom, pop a sleeping pill. I was in bed by like 6:37. And I would wake up. It was like 2, 3 a.m. And I don't feel like drinking, but I've still got all this time before I have to like be anywhere. So that's when I just started. I never watched TV my whole life. Still don't. And I just have no interest in it. And then I somehow came across this YouTube video of Earl Nightingale, which was this, I don't know. Do you know who Earl Nightingale was?
Yeah, name super familiar, but I'm not getting the face. Yeah.
Former radio TV host, worked with like Napoleon Hill and Bob Proctor. And I don't want to call him a motivational guy, but I started listening to this guy talk about the subconscious mind. And that was kind of lining up with the stuff I was learning in the traumatic brain injury clinic, the TBI clinic, about neuroscience. And then that led me to like Ed Milet, and Ed Milet led me to like Tony Robbins, and Tony Robbins to John Assaroff, and John Assaroff to Joe Dispenza. And all of a sudden I started to just like listen to what all these people were saying with this free time that I had in the morning. And I just started to build momentum, and I started to change my thoughts, which changed my emotions, which changed my behavioral patterns. And that's a scientific fact for all humans, by the way. You know, you have the ability to consciously intervene against your thoughts, which are negative by default for survival reasons. And as I just began to build momentum, you know, I just started to focus on the things that I could change in the future and the life that I wanted. And I found purpose in trying to help people. Specifically, I wanted to help schools with active shooter stuff. None of them wanted to work with me for whatever reason, bunch of idiots who run our schools. I mean, it's basic science. The further you are from somebody trying to shoot you, easier it is to survive, just so everybody knows. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't all like linear. There was a lot of ups and downs. Like I lost all my money leaving the military. Like the day I EAS'd, I was driving back to Chicago and I lost everything that I had ever saved, high risk stock options trading, took out a loan, lost all that right away. You know, found some jobs, worked my way up. And so there was ups and downs and left and rights, but that really just is the testament to staying focused on where you want to go in life and not the problems that you're having. So I just built up momentum, man. And things turned around really quick.
So I think you mentioned something that I'm kind of curious about, momentum. And I feel like momentum can go both ways. You know, I was thinking about it kind of during my transition the last couple of years of momentum compounds, you know, like your decisions compound for better or for worse. And recreating that momentum can definitely be difficult. And I think that like getting out of the military, like you were building this momentum towards a military career because you're kind of like required to. Like if you want to get promoted and be successful in the military, you have to build this momentum. But as soon as you transition, it's like that momentum is almost worthless, you know? And you have to start making decisions that compound in the civilian world rather than the military. And it's interesting that you talk about, you know, you found these people online, like following people, which I feel like could have momentum in a good direction or a bad direction, depending on who you follow.
Yeah.
And social media is like, it's a tool, but it's also a problem for many people. So like, how do you go about like filtering your consumption of media and influence in order to give you good momentum rather than bad momentum?
So all things are energy, and energy is in motion, and it will remain in that motion unless it is influenced by an external force, right? Newton's law of motion. And that applies to all things, not just some physical object that we can see, because that physical object is technically still energy. All things are energy. Everything vibrates at a certain frequency. So absolutely. And I think when people leave the military, they focus on the wrong type of momentum, like the identity crisis that people have and the purposelessness that they suffer from. Cause I did suffer from that a little bit when I got out the second time, where it's like, okay, well, what am I? Who am I? And a Marine, I really disagree at this point now, where it's like, I'm a Marine. No, like you have, you know, these capabilities, the characteristics of discipline or training or skill set, whatever, but you were just a Marine. Like that's all it really was. And nobody gives a shit after you get out. Even if you do 20, 25, 30 years, you still have a lot of life to live after that. Yeah. And if you absorb yourself into that identity, just like cops do, then you're going to be depressed and probably kill yourself. So focusing on the wrong types of momentum, because energy, where your attention goes, your energy flows. And where that energy flows is where the momentum comes behind it. And the way that I decipher what's constructive or not constructive is, what's my goal in life? And does this help me to do it? And even distill it further down, because there was a couple of years ago, I found myself literally watching all these amazing people with all this great information. Yeah. But it's like way too much of my time is spent just listening to other people talk and not doing anything. Mm. So I just cut it out to like, hey, this year I'm going to listen to Ed Milet. That's really it. That's who I'm going to listen to this year. And then maybe I'll add like one or two ancillary people, but I basically just block everybody else at this point. So is it helping you get to your goals? How is it helping you build new skills or discover more value within yourself? Yeah. Are you accomplishing something by actually listening to it and then greatly reducing how often you do listen to it? Yeah. And then you look at something like porn. You know, I've really discovered not just like the physiological negatives of watching porn, but just like the true addictive nature of it psychologically and emotionally as well, and how it damages us. And if you listen to Ed Milet or Tony Robbins for an hour, and then you learn and you write something down, you go apply it in your life towards your goal. Okay, cool. I can't learn anything from something like porn or World Star Fights or any of this other cat video stuff. Mm-hmm. That's wasted. That's wasted time, wasted energy, wasted attention. And again, where your attention goes, your energy flows. And behind that energy is momentum. And so if you are putting your attention towards things that are dragging you down, what I call the true self, your max version of you, and the actual self. And this is the next book that I'll probably come out with. But the actual self is where you're at. I'm breaking all these promises. My attention's going somewhere negative that pulls me away from my dreams and aspirations. Momentum downwards. But when you are working towards that true self, then you're realigning that actual self with the true self. And the distance between the two, this is angst and depression. And so the more that there is, the more weight, the more momentum, then the more hopelessness you feel. And so the much more difficult, more difficult it is to turn that all around. And when you do begin to turn around, you don't just like start going back up. It's like the bottom of a wave. You really have to begin to turn yourself back around. But the beautiful thing is, just like a rocket ship, when it's taking off from the earth, it requires the most thrust when it's on the ground.
Yeah.
And just like you and me and any other source of energy in this universe, we require the most thrust when we begin to change direction. And so once we've gained a little bit of momentum, and once we start breaking past, you know, the gravitational force of whatever problems it is that we're dealing with, then we start to use a little bit of thrust to gain a lot more momentum, and it does become easier.
Yeah. No, well said. Well said. And it's, yeah, I mean, I appreciate that you brought up that it's not linear. It's exponential. You know, even if you're going on a downward trend, you know, it's an exponential downward trend if you're going to try to pick it up. You know, at some point, you're going to be able to turn it around as long as you start changing your habits and your actions. But it's not going to happen overnight, you know, and you got to stick to it and know that, like, I know what I'm doing is going to improve me. And eventually I'll build that positive momentum that will compound on itself.
And the importance in that transition, I just want to mention really quick, is mental and emotional resiliency. Mm-hmm. If you don't have mental and emotional resiliency, you're not going to transfer. You're not going to begin to redirect that energy and that momentum. And this is why physical exercise is just such a pinnacle cornerstone of my existence, because nothing is harder than forcing yourself to do an arduous workout. And this is why coaches to me are so important, is because you need to have something assigned to you, and then you need to be doing it and held accountable. Because in those moments when you're talking to yourself, like, one more, 10 more, I got this, fuck, I'm not going to give up. Now you're building true mental and emotional resiliency. And this, I'm not going to break down how that rewires the brain and actually constructs and creates new neural patterns associated with mental and emotional resilience, but you need to have that. And if you don't have that, you're going to be like, oh, I want to go back up. And you're just going to keep going down and not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, resiliency and continuing when you want to quit is like, it's such a surefire way of increasing confidence. And as you increase confidence, like, everything else becomes possible, you know? And you start ignoring the naysayers and the things that you used to maybe object in your own thoughts. So I'm curious, if you were to give a couple action items for people that are like, shoot, I'm in the pits, I'm on a downward trajectory, how do I turn this around? What are some of the key action items that you would suggest and that you used?
Wake up at now I get up at anywhere between like 2:30, 3:30 a.m. every single day. You don't have to get up that early, but I do recommend that you wake up at 4:55 minimum. I don't do that, but you need to wake up at 4:55 minimum. Why? Because it's difficult. That's the whole point. And you cannot, it's insanity to do the same things physically every single day, to think the same things mentally every single day and expect change. Like, it's not going to change. So what do? We take drastic, massive action, wake up at 4:55. And if you already do wake up at 4:55, wake up 30 minutes earlier then. I don't care. The point is to wake up earlier so that it's difficult. Then I recommend you drink a tall glass of water. I have a big thing on water. All the bullshit they put in water these days, you need to be drinking good alkalinated magnesium based water, just natural stuff. That's the first thing right there. Wake up earlier, drink a tall glass of water first thing right when you wake up. Sounds stupid. Like, some of my wealthier clients are like, this is dumb. And I'm like, see if you could do it. Mm-hmm. See if you could do it. and how it begins to change. You're building momentum. You don't want to start building momentum with big tasks. It needs to be small little changes so that it's almost inconceivable. But yet before you know it, you're like, oh, my behavior is different. My thoughts are different. I'm more hydrated, so I'm thinking more clearly.
Yeah.
Then the third thing would be do 300 burpees. Do 300 burpees every single, if you don't already work out at the gym, then do 300 burpees. Physiologically change the chemical components within your body, because we have negative default belief systems, which produce negative endocrine response, negative neurochemicals, hormones in the body associated with survivalism. You can't think creatively when you're surviving, even if it's in a moderated sympathetic state of survivalism in this modern society. And so when you're stressed, you don't think clearly and creatively. When you don't think clearly and creatively, then you're in survival mode and you can't be successful. So for the most part, so wake up early, drink tall glass of water, do exercise. 300 burpees is a good place to start. And that physiologically changes the hormones in your body, which physiologically changes the component wiring in your brain, which then therefore mentally changes your thought process, which therefore changes your emotions, which therefore changes your actions. And your actions are going to directly correlate with the external environment around you.
I like it. I like it. You just inspired me, because I'm like, I know some people that get up super early. And, you know, I'm a five guy. I'm like, all right, I can get up at five, do my reading, get to the gym by six when it opens. But at the same time, I could get a whole lot more done if I were to get up an hour earlier. And who needs 7 hours of sleep, really?
I mean, truly, yeah, but we don't need 7 hours of sleep. And, dude, 1 hour a week or 1 hour a day is
uninterrupted, when nobody else is awake.
And that's the huge thing, too, is, like, your ability to focus. But I mean, that's 365 hours a year. I think that's like 6 or 8 total work weeks or something like that. Yeah. That's 6 or 8 40 hour work weeks. That's 2 months that you just gained from waking up an hour earlier and doing something uninterrupted and focused.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. No, it's some solid advice. I'm curious, you know, I was reintroduced to you because I keep seeing your content online. And so clearly your 3 a.m. wake ups are having a positive impact on, you know, you're constantly documenting your mornings. You know, you prove to the world that you're up that early. But I kind of want to talk about, like, what you're doing now. And, you know, you've started this Lethal University. You're using your experience from MARSOC, from combat, to help, help people protect themselves, protect their family, protect their home. And I'm just kind of curious, I don't know if you want to go into it, but I mean, like, what experiences, you know, from MARSOC, can you go into anything? Like, you know, I have realized that if you want to go into business, going special operations is like, seems like a cheat code in order to get into business, because everybody wants to, like, associate with you. But I'm curious, what transpired to say, I want to stay in this world. I want to, you know, teach people how to protect their family rather than do something else.
I remember I had this event where I'm like running with all these like local Indige forces, and there's like a lot of chaos going on. And I just remember thinking to myself how calm I felt and how I saw things so clearly. And I remember thinking to myself, I was like, this all has been divine intervention to bring me here. I mean, look at the fact that I wasn't on that airplane, you know, like, just, I know that I have a purpose in this life. And for whatever reason, it's to teach people how to be safe against violence. You know, from my time as a drug addict, little kid, to, you know, getting beat up and jumped and doing crazy, shady drug deals in the most violent neighborhoods in the world, to MARSOC, to even when I did overseas contracting afterwards, man, I was over in Africa and there was some shady shit going on. And, you know, ultimately I care about people and I want people to have the ability to defend themselves, because I think the only way we could truly rid ourselves of crime is if everybody does have the ability to defend themselves with justified lethal force. It builds your confidence, it reduces social anxiety, and it allows you to trust your fellow mankind a lot more. Because when you know that you're capable of defending yourself against douchebags, you're that much more open and likely to engage with people. And most people are good people. And so therefore, you're having a better, more positive present experience in life. But we just don't know how to defend ourselves. And security is the number one basic necessity all humans need. It exists in the unconscious part of the brain. And if you don't know how to defend yourself against violence, your brain knows that. Your conscious brain doesn't, but your unconscious brain does. Therefore, it affects your sympathetic nervous system and your anxiety and all that stuff. So I just feel like I'm called to help people.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'm curious because, you know, I think no matter what job you were, you had in the Marine Corps, you know, like I was an air wing guy, and like, you know, you think like, oh, you've got a basic level of competence in security from like, you know, training. But at the same time, it's like, let's be real. You know, what are the possible risks? What are the possible interactions that you might come across that you may have to, you know, protect yourself or protect your family? Based on, you know, your experience in MARSOC and contracting, you know, most people listening to this are in the military. Are they lying to themselves, thinking that they are adequately prepared based on their military training, the average military training?
A little bit, you know, but not entirely. And that's actually where the Lethality University came from, is I wanted to help veterans transitioning out to find purpose. And that kind of morphed into, well, like, let's get your skills up, you know, like, sure, you're trainable and you have like a general understanding and idea, but you've got a lot of room to grow, man. I mean, that's what makes somebody so lethal, you know, and lethality is your discipline, your mindset, your belief systems, your habits, your skill sets. It's not just being deadly. And so there is a lot of misnomer and misconception. People don't understand the science behind, you know, deadly force and lethality and discipline, and you need to be held accountable in a community. And so there's like, I would say for somebody generally who's like, yeah, I'm prepared, I'm good, you're probably like 25%. Yeah. And if you like boast about it, you're probably more like 10%. I mean, yeah, you know, just in what I've seen. Sure. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't quickly become so much better than you are. Yeah. You just got to be honest with yourself and accept the correction and trust the process from somebody who's been there. Yeah. And then just roll with it, man, and put in the work and you'll be that much better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting shift that takes place. Yeah. When it's just you, you're like, yeah, I'll get into scrap. I'll be all right. But as soon as you have a family and kids and like the significance of your readiness matters. I mean, like there's far more responsibility. And so it's like, you know, you can't just kind of brush it off like, yeah, I'll be fine. Cause it's like, well, if you're not fine, then it's your family kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think it's an important, thing, especially for men and fathers to consider, like, am I adequately prepared to protect my family? And so I appreciate what you're doing. Yeah, you're putting out a lot of good content, and so it's been cool to see.
Cool, man. Yeah. Just, you know, you hit on such a good point. That's actually one of my biggest frustrations is when people just kind of shove it off. Like, I'm good. Mm-hmm. It's like, dude, what would you do if you're giving your kid a bath and somebody kicks in your door downstairs? And what we're seeing right now with this migrant stuff, literally violent gangs from, like, by the way, gangs in Belize mm-hmm. are a lot different than gangs in America. So if people mm-hmm. think like, oh, it's just a gang. No, these are like coordinated attacks on people's homes with 5, 6, I think the most I saw so far was 7. And a federal judge in Illinois just said illegal immigrants can carry guns legally, which is even more insane. So what do you do if you get somebody kicking in your door while you're giving your kid a bath? Do you have a weapon system that is safely stored throughout your house that you could adequately run to without having to cross and intersect, you know, with that violent criminal? You know, that you could regress to? Where does your family go in times of an emergency? What's your shoot, no shoot wall, shoot through wall? Like, what does your home security system even look like? Yeah, it's crazy how unprepared a lot of people are. And it's been very eye-opening, which is why it's the Home Defense Series is the first segment of the Lethal You that we're going to launch with Bradley and his people. I was telling you about that just before this. It's got to start at home. And that's why I chose to go with that one. And I'm pretty pumped for that. It's going to be cool.
Nice. Right on. That brings up a good point when you're talking about, you know, a specific situation, bathing your kids upstairs and having adequate weapon systems throughout your home. Where's the line between paranoia and readiness?
It's in your internal state. So like, are you constantly in this heightened state of alert and anxiety? And if you are, it's because you're not prepared enough. And being prepared means that you're just present and that you're ready. You know, like if you're going into a ball game and like active situation, it's like, yeah, you're a little nervous, But all you got to do is focus on the process that you've had established, that you've practiced and repeated so many times before. I'm not saying you got to do house drills every single day, but having a plan in place is better than no plan. And having rehearsed it once or twice is more than 99% of what people do to begin with. Yeah. And criminals aren't ready for that. You know, they can't be, because you're in the defense. You have the advantage. You have the castle. It's home field. Yeah. But yeah, so the line, the delineation is really how it affects your everyday life, your state of mind. You know, are you paranoid? You know, are you overly anxious? Because that's like, that's not cool. That's not a life worth living. Yeah. And if you are, well, hit me up, because it's pretty simple to get you fixed, man. Like, all we got to do is a couple of things and you'll be like, okay, cool. I was just nervous because I didn't know if I was doing it right. You know, that's usually what it comes down to.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the bar is very low in life. You know, like the average, if you want to get into business, if you want to get into anything, it's like, it really doesn't take that much to be above average. And so if a criminal is looking for targets, they're expecting average. And so like as soon as, and most criminals at best are average criminals, you know? So it's like, in order to deter an average criminal, you just have to be a slightly above average non-criminal, you know?
Defendant. Yeah. Yeah. There's actually only four questions that a criminal is going to ask themselves in terms of like, are you a viable candidate? And the first thing is like, do you have something that I want to take? Mm-hmm. And sure, go ahead, show your stuff off. It's America. You're supposed to be able to live freely like that, right? The next question they're going to ask themselves is, can I take it and get away with it? So like, will I ever get caught doing it? Will I get caught in the process? And if the answer is you'll get caught or you'll get caught in the process, okay, now they're going to start to second guess it, right? Because it's survival based. Nobody wants to get caught breaking into a house and get shot or get arrested, degradational lifestyle. The next question is, do I have the resources to do this by myself? Or do I need to go get new tools, new items, other people? Because the more that they have to get, the more energy is spent. Survival-based part of the brain says, I don't want to spend energy. I want to be lazy. I want this to be easy. So that's going to be another, you know, And then lastly is like, well, can I get more intel, more information before I kind of like make up, you know, my choice on this? And if the answer is no, well, what you just did right there is, I mean, you just crushed the criminal decision-making process. Mm. Do I have something that they want to take? If they don't even say yes to that to begin with, I mean, then, you know, at that point, they're going to move to the next house and they're going to look for something they want to take.
Interesting. Interesting. That's a fantastic breakdown. Yeah. I appreciate that. I think that's a good place to wrap it up, dude.
Cool.
That's great. Where can people connect with you? Where can people learn more about Lethal You and see what Joe Malone's up to?
Joseph Malone Official on Instagram, joemalonetraining.com. is the website, and then the Lethality University. We're going to get that up here pretty soon, but anybody could reach out to me on Instagram, and yeah, man, we'll have a conversation.
Awesome, man. I appreciate you hanging out with me today. I'm going to make sure that all those links are in the description, and I wish you the best of luck. I'm going to keep following you on Instagram and watch you guys grow.
Cool, man. I'm glad to see you're doing good, man. It's cool to catch up.
Absolutely, man. Thank you. Hey, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Joe Malone. Great guy. Really, really cool to see what he's doing. And I hope that you guys will go give him a follow on Instagram as he builds out his business and as he shares value and helps you protect yourself and your family and those that you love. And so definitely go check him out. Links are in the description. Additionally, I used to have an Instagram for Military Bottom Line, but I got really sick of making memes and like doing the stupid stuff that I felt like I had to do in order to grow at Instagram. And so if you guys are looking for me on Instagram, it's just under my personal name at Jason Birds, JasonBurds. Link is in the description. And I'm just trying to like be more me on that Instagram instead of posting military memes and stuff that I just don't care about. And so go follow me there. See you guys soon. Peace.